Welcome to Lecture 15, Distant Worlds and Solar System Debris. In the previous lecture, we discussed two gargantuan planets, Jupiter and Saturn. Now, the next one out is Uranus. And due to a frequently used but incorrect pronunciation, this planet is the butt of many jokes. The correct pronunciation is Uranus. Its properties are summarized right here. It's quite far from the Sun, about 19 astronomical units, 19 times as far away as the Earth. It's got an orbital period of around 84 years. It's four times the radius of Earth. That is considerably smaller than both Jupiter and Saturn, and only about 15 times the mass of the Earth. Again, considerably smaller than Jupiter and Saturn, but still large compared with the terrestrial planets. It's got a low density, but not as low as that of Saturn. Saturn, with a density lower than that of water, could float on an ocean on Earth if there were one big enough to hold it. But Uranus is somewhat denser, indicating a mixture more of rock and ice rather than gases like hydrogen. It spins rapidly, as do the other giant planets, but again, not as rapidly as Jupiter and Saturn. So it doesn't appear quite as squashed. Jupiter and Saturn actually look visibly squashed because they're spinning so quickly and their equator bulges out. Uranus and Neptune don't look so squashed. It's got a peculiar rotation axis, tipped 98 degrees away from the perpendicular to its orbital plane, and we'll discuss the seasonal effects having to do with that. And it's got 17 moons. I mentioned 15 last time, but it turns out there are an additional two unnamed moons. So right now there are 17 known and possibly more. Who knows how many there really are. Well, it was discovered in 1781 by William Herschel. This is the first of the planets not known to the ancients. And one wonders then how astrological tables would have to be changed when suddenly new planets are discovered, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Does that change one's horoscope or not? Does that mean that thousands of years of horoscopes were all wrong? I don't know. I'm not an astrology expert, I guess. It's got, as I said, many moons, but here three of them are marked. One, two, and three. It's dim and distant, hard to see. Rather featureless atmosphere. You can see here the image taken by the Voyager spacecraft. No clouds, no striations, unlike Jupiter. Only in a severe computer enhancement can you see any sort of a temperature change going from the pole to the equator. So quite featureless. Here's Jupiter once again in comparison, and you can see all the bands and storms, the great red spot, which is twice the size of the Earth. We think that Jupiter has far more activity in its atmosphere than Uranus does for three reasons. First, Jupiter is closer to the Sun, so it gets heated a lot more. Uranus's atmospheric temperature is only 60 degrees above absolute zero. Second, Jupiter is much bigger, and it has retained a lot more of the heat that it stored up when it was gravitationally contracting to form a planet. And that heat is slowly leaking out and churning up the atmosphere. And finally, parts of Jupiter's interior might still be contracting gravitationally a little bit. And that process lets out energy and churns up the atmosphere. So it's quite a difference in their atmospheric structure. Here we compare the internal structure of Uranus with that of Saturn. Now recall, Saturn looked kind of like Jupiter. It's got molecular hydrogen below its outer colorful atmosphere, and then metallic hydrogen, and then ices of sorts, and rock. Uranus does not have sufficient pressure in its interior to transform molecular hydrogen into metallic hydrogen. This form of metallic hydrogen requires huge pressures, which really cram the molecules together and cause them to strip the electrons off of each other, allowing the electrons to flow freely and conduct heat and electricity. Uranus and Neptune simply don't have enough mass to produce those kinds of pressures deep in the interior. So there's essentially no metallic hydrogen. Now here you can see the effect of Uranus's strange axis of rotation. Let me actually illustrate that first with a model. Here's the Sun, and here's Uranus orbiting the Sun. Its axis of rotation is tipped 98 degrees relative to the perpendicular to the orbit. So it's almost in the orbital plane. That means that for about 21 years of Uranus's orbit, the equator is pointed roughly towards the sun. Then for roughly 21 years, the North Pole is pointed towards the sun. Then for another 21 years, the equator is pointed towards the sun. And finally, for another 21 years, roughly the South Pole or the Southern Hemisphere is pointed toward the sun. So the seasons last 21 years each on Uranus. And during those seasons, either one hemisphere or the other, in the case of the summer and winter, are completely illuminated and the other one is in the dark. So this is really quite an extreme case for the seasons, much more extreme than for our Earth, whose axis is tilted by only 23.5 degrees, and so we have much more mild variations. In this diagram, you can see what I just said, what I just showed in the model. First, axis B, or hemisphere B, is pointed toward the sun, and then later on, the equator is more viewing the sun like that. 21 years later, the other pole is viewing the sun, and then 21 years later, the equator is once again predominantly pointed toward the sun. So this is really quite extreme. However, despite these extreme seasonal variations in the heating, somehow the heat gets distributed quite uniformly through the atmosphere. We saw in a previous image that the atmosphere was nearly featureless. There was a slight temperature gradient, but there was nothing like huge storms or anything like that being produced by this uneven heating. And that is not entirely understood yet, how the heat circulates within Uranus's atmosphere to spread out fairly evenly in this manner. Well, an interesting discovery was made in 1977 when Uranus passed in front of or occulted a star. The measurement was made of the star's brightness before the occultation, and we expected the star's brightness to be constant for a while and then to gradually decrease as it went through Uranus's outer atmosphere. That would be a way of studying the atmosphere's thickness and density, things like that. Then we expected the star to be completely blotted out by the planet and then to gradually reemerge. Well, fortunately, the star's brightness was monitored considerably before the planet was expected to pass in front of it. And what was actually seen is the following. There were these little dips in brightness of the star well before the planet itself occulted the star. And then once the planet came out from in front of the star, the dips were seen once again, but in reverse order. This was interpreted to be a series of rings, very narrow rings, because the dips did not take very long to occur in time. So, in fact, it was figured out that the rings are only about 10 kilometers wide. And also very thin rings, that is, the light passing through them wasn't diminished very much in brightness. It didn't go down all the way to zero the way it did when the planet's disk itself covered the star. This was quite a surprise because these sorts of thin rings are dynamically unstable. They should spread apart very, very quickly with time. Even Saturn's rings present somewhat of a problem if you want them to last for billions of years. Peter Goldreich and Scott Tremaine at Caltech suggested that each ring has two little moons on either side of it called shepherd moons. And these moons keep the particles in the ring from spreading out. Here's roughly how this goes. The moon that's slightly closer to Uranus than the ring particles are orbits Uranus faster than the ring particles. That's just a consequence of Kepler's third law. So it passes a given particle as it's moving along. Suppose a particle deviates toward that moon while it's spreading out from the ring. The moon will give a kick to that particle as it passes that particle, thereby driving it back outwards. Higher energy orbits are farther out. All right? So the inward spreading particles get driven back out. In a similar way, the particles spreading outward from the ring toward the outer shepherd moon get kicked back in. Okay? So the shepherd moons maintain the thinness, the width, the narrow width of the rings. This was a prediction that was made, and it was thought that probably each of the 11 rings has a little moonlet on either side. In some cases, a given moon could act as a shepherd for either of the two adjacent rings, of course. Well, when Voyager flew by Uranus in January of 1986, it showed how very thin, how very narrow the rings really are. They really are just a few kilometers, a few tens of kilometers thick or narrow. And in most cases, Shepherd moons were not seen. Only a small part of the rings was imaged. Also, the moons are expected to be faint, so perhaps it's no surprise that the Shepherd moons weren't seen. But in one case, the Shepherd moons were seen. For the outermost ring, the biggest ring, it's about 100 kilometers wide, two little moons, Ophelia and Cordelia, were found next to that ring. So this was a great triumph for classical dynamical physics. People did not expect such narrow rings to exist unless there were shepherds keeping them in tow, and indeed the shepherds were found, at least for the most obvious ring. Uranus's magnetic field also presented an interesting puzzle. Uranus is just a fun planet. Its magnetic field is shaped like that of a bar magnet, as is the case for the other planets, but it is offset from the center, unlike the case for most of the other planets, and it is tilted by about 60 degrees relative to the axis of rotation. Now, in the Earth's case, the bar magnet is roughly centered on the center of the Earth, and the tilt of the magnetic field is just a few degrees away from true north and true south. But a tilt of 60 degrees was unprecedented, and people speculated that maybe Uranus's strange axis of rotation, tilted by 98 degrees, is somehow related to this peculiar magnetic field. Maybe they have a common origin. We will see when we study Neptune that that's unlikely to be the correct explanation, actually. So there was great euphoria in the study of Uranus, and then there was additional excitement when one of Uranus's moons was imaged. This is Miranda. It's about 500 kilometers in diameter. It's a relatively small moon, but it's got all sorts of crazy surface features. Deep canyons right here, lots of canyons actually, interesting striations. This was unexpected for a moon of such a small size. Big moons have crustal upheavals and bending things and all that due to motions of molten material on the inside. And very small moons, like those of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, they have giant craters and are misshapen simply because they were never completely molten and didn't form a spherical nice shape. But a moon of intermediate size like this was predicted to be fairly smooth because it would have been molten enough to form a spherical shape, but not sufficiently active on the inside to form giant canyons and crustal upheavals and things like that. Again, we learned that our knowledge of the planets and moons in the solar system is incomplete. Miranda was quite a surprise in how it appeared. So all this came in around January 24th, 25th, 1986, and everyone at NASA was on cloud nine. It was a wonderful time because Voyager 2 lasted that long and sent back such spectacular results. Unfortunately, a few days later, this tremendous tragedy of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster occurred. The Space Shuttle Challenger blew up with seven humans on board. A terrible blow to the whole space program and to the people and the families of these people. So the euphoria of Uranus lasted only a short time. Let's move on now to Neptune. Neptune is even farther out from the Sun than Uranus is. It's way out there, very dim. It's got about eight moons, only a few of which are easily seen from the ground. Here's one of them. Neptune was actually sighted by Galileo in 1613. He was drawing the moons of Jupiter, plotting their orbits, and Neptune happened to be in the same field of view. And he noticed it, and he drew it in his notebook, and he even mentioned that it didn't seem to be staying put like the other fixed stars. It seemed to be kind of moving a little bit, like Jupiter and its moons, but it wasn't quite moving with them either, so it wasn't part of the Jupiter system. He did not recognize it as a planet. He didn't call it a separate planet, but he might have discovered it. Similarly, I should mention Uranus actually appeared on several star maps well prior to Herschel's discovery in 1781, but Uranus was never recognized as a planet until Herschel recognized it as such. So here's how Neptune was discovered. It was noticed that Uranus's observed orbit, its observed position among the stars, differed a little bit from the predicted positions. And this was calculated by two physicists, Adams in England and Le Verrier in France. They figured out that there must be some sort of an object perturbing the orbit of Uranus out farther from the solar system. And they independently, within a year of each other, calculated the position of this planet. They tried to convince people to look for it, but for a while they didn't have any success, until a fellow named Galley in Berlin took a look at the predicted position, and within hours he noticed a planet there, something that was moving from one photograph to another, right where Le Verrier and Adams had predicted it to be. So this was, again, a triumph of classical physics, noticing that the results of observations don't agree exactly with predictions, calculating what sort of an effect might produce that deviation, and then going out and looking at nature, looking for one's prediction. Neptune was visited in 1989 by the Voyager spacecraft, once again receiving a boost and a slight change in direction by going past Uranus. That's the same thing as what happened in getting to Uranus. It was given a boost and a change in direction going past Saturn. And it reached it in 1989, and it sent back fantastic photographs. The greatest surprise was that Neptune's atmosphere was incredibly dynamic. Remember, Uranus had this really bizarre, well, bizarre in the sense of totally uniform-looking atmosphere, nothing interesting going on except for perhaps this business of redistributing the heat from one pole over the rest of the planet, but no interesting features. Well, look at Neptune. It's got a giant, great dark spot about the size of the Earth. This is reminiscent of Jupiter's great red spot, which is 2 to 3 times bigger, but still, you know, Neptune has a nice big spot here. It's got methane ice clouds skirting around the spot. It's got other storms, like this one down here, and a little cloud bunch called Scooter, because it scoots around the planet with a speed of 1,100 kilometers per hour. 1,100 kilometers per hour, that's about 700 miles per hour. You think the storms and hurricanes here on Earth are vicious. Try being out there on Neptune. Really dynamic atmosphere. It's not understood why Neptune's atmosphere is so dynamic. Uranus's was not very much so at all. And Neptune is even farther from the Sun than Uranus is. Perhaps Neptune's interior is still contracting gravitationally, releasing energy which drives these storms. You might be interested in what causes these beautiful bluish or bluish-green colors. Both Uranus and Neptune have this approximate color. It's due to methane in the atmosphere. The outer parts of Uranus and Neptune have methane, and methane's molecular structure absorbs red and infrared colors, and orange to some extent, and reflects the blues and the greens. And so Uranus and Neptune are blue planets, but for a reason that differs from that of the Earth. If we look now at this picture of taken by Voyager, you can see a very much overexposed image of the planet. And then these arcs, all right? These are actually parts of complete rings. It's a bit hard to see in this photograph, but the rings are actually complete, and the arcs are denser regions within those rings. The arcs were known prior to the Voyager flyby. They were discovered during an occultation of a star by Neptune, much like the discovery of Uranus's rings. But in the case of Neptune, the star blinked out on one side of the planet, but not on the other side, and that's why it was deduced that these were arcs. The Voyager pictures show that these are actually complete rings, but over most of the ring, the amount of material is much smaller than in the case of these clumps right here. So now we see that all of the giant planets in the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, have rings. So Saturn is far from unique in having rings. It's just unique in having the biggest, broadest rings. Neptune's magnetic field turned out to be similar to that of Uranus. It's inclined by 55 degrees relative to the rotation axis, and it's way off center. Look, if it were centered, the center of this bar magnet would be at the center of Neptune, and it's way off, about half the diameter of the planet. Yet Neptune's axis of rotation is not greatly tipped relative to the orbital plane, or the perpendicular to the orbital plane. So the hypothesis that Uranus's axis of rotation and its magnetic field are both tipped for the same reason is probably wrong, because Neptune's axis is not tipped very much, yet its magnetic field is just as strange as that of Uranus. So we're not exactly sure what's going on here. Probably there's some sort of circulation of conductive material in a shell around the core of both Uranus and Neptune. But the magnetism of planets is still not a very well understood effect. Neptune's perhaps greatest surprise was its wonderful moon, Triton. Triton is a large moon, and you can see here that it has a very interesting terrain. There's large differences in the terrain. It's perhaps the most varied surface we've seen in the solar system. Let me show you some close-ups of this particular photograph. Here you can see these dark bands coming from what looks like a little bright region. There's a bunch of these things, about 50 of them. These are actually thought to be due to ice volcanoes. The surface of Triton is made largely out of frozen methane. The sunlight warms the methane, doesn't quite evaporate it, but the solid nitrogen ice below that layer does get heated up and it sublimates. It doesn't go to a liquid, it goes to a gaseous form. And it comes out through fissures in the methane crust and goes shooting out. These nitrogen molecules go shooting out. And then apparently a wind layer above the surface pushes them over, like the smoke in a smokestack being pushed over when it hits a wind layer above the smokestack. So there are a few photographs of these things which show sort of the smokestack coming up and then taking almost a 90-degree turn. So these ice volcanoes are quite unlike any of the volcanic things we've seen on Earth or elsewhere, and that's because Neptune and Triton are way colder than anything that we've experienced. Neptune and Triton have a temperature of only about 40 degrees above absolute zero. Triton hovers at around 40, partly because it's very reflective. It's got this snowy, methane, icy surface that reflects sunlight very well, and it just doesn't heat the surface of the moon very much. So that was really weird. Other strange terrain can be seen here. This is called the Cantaloupe terrain. Looks like just the sort of little basins that have collapsed in an icy surface in a way that resembles the skin of a cantaloupe. And that's not really very well understood. But clearly, Triton has a very geologically active surface. And here is the view back towards Neptune and Triton as Voyager was leaving a tremendous reconnaissance of the planets, one that exceeded everyone's expectations. Really, Uranus and Neptune were sort of the cherries on top of the cake. And this moment led Ed Stone, the project scientist, to quote T.S. Eliot. He said, "Not farewell, but fare forward, brave voyagers." It was just a magnificent success for NASA. Let's move on to the outermost planet of our solar system, Pluto. Here you can see the Discovery photographs of Pluto. If you're very sharp-eyed, you'll notice that there's one star-like object that appears to have moved between the two photographs. There it is in one photograph, and here it is in the other. Wow, that would be tough to notice. How was it ever found? Well, it turns out that even after the discovery of Neptune, it still looked like Uranus's orbit was a tiny bit off from the prediction. It wasn't exactly at the predicted position. And so a ninth planet was postulated by some people, and they calculated where it would be. Clyde Tombaugh at the Lowell Observatory searched that region of the sky very diligently and found a planet in roughly the predicted position. Now, the predictions were fairly coarse because the masses of Neptune and the other planets weren't known very well. Neptune in particular didn't have a very well-determined mass. So it was unknown exactly how much it perturbs Uranus's orbit. Okay. So Clyde Tombaugh found it. It turns out, in retrospect, now that we know the masses of the planets, Pluto is a very small planet. and it could not have had the calculated effect on Uranus. So the discovery was kind of accidental. It happened to have been in the right part of the sky where Clyde Tombaugh looked, but it could not have had that effect on Uranus. So you might say, well, why did Uranus's orbit appear to deviate from the prediction? And the result was, the answer is that probably because the wrong mass had been used for Neptune. So it doesn't deviate from its predicted orbit. And the discovery of Pluto is really a credit to Clyde Tombaugh's tremendous observing skills. You can see that Pluto has a very strange orbit. First of all, in the plane of the sky, it actually crosses, or in the plane of this sheet of paper, it crosses the orbit of Neptune. They don't actually intersect because Pluto's plane is tilted relative to Neptune's plane. In fact, Pluto's tilt of 17 degrees is the largest tilt in the solar system of any planet. But they do cross in the sense that Pluto is sometimes closer to the Sun than Neptune is. And such an interval has occurred from 1979 to 1999. So right now in 1998, we're pretty much in the last year of this interesting configuration. So if you were on a talk show between 1979 and 1999, they asked you, what is the most distant planet from the Sun? Your answer should be Neptune, if the question was, what is the most distant planet from the Sun now? And if they marked you wrong for that answer, you would have a legitimate reason to complain. Okay. Now, on average, Pluto is the most distant planet from the Sun, roughly 40 astronomical units out. But it's got this very eccentric orbit, a highly elliptical orbit, and sometimes it passes closer than Neptune does. Here's a summary of the properties of Pluto. About 40 AU out, takes 250 years to orbit the Sun. Very small radius, 20% of Earth's radius, and a small density, 2 grams per cubic centimeter, leading to a mass which is minuscule compared to that of Earth. Interestingly, the density is intermediate between that of the giant planets and the terrestrial planets, which hover more at around 5 grams per cubic centimeter. And it's thought that Pluto consists mostly of rocks and ice, not of an iron core and heavy rocks like Earth and Mercury, nor does it consist of gases or liquids like the giant planets. So it's sort of in between. In fact, its density and its composition are thought to be very similar to those of Triton. Triton has essentially the same density and, again, is thought to consist of ices and things like that. It has about the same size as Pluto as well. Here is a moon of Pluto. All right, this is called Charon. It was discovered in 1978 when photographs were taken of Pluto in order to refine its orbit. And James Christie noticed that in some of the photographs, Pluto seemed to have a little bump sticking out its side. That bump was way too big to be a mountain, and moreover, it changed orientations in such a way that it looked like it was kind of orbiting the planet. And indeed, later pictures show that it is a moon. This is about the best ground-based picture that has been taken. Here is a picture taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. You could drive a truck between the two objects in this picture, showing the very fine resolution of the space telescope. With many Hubble Space Telescope pictures and with image reprocessing techniques, you can actually see some low contrast surface features on Pluto. The poles seem to be kind of bright, as though they have fresh, highly reflective ice on them. And then there are some dark regions and other bright regions. Admittedly, this is not a tremendously good photograph, but it's much better than what had been obtained before. And we are not in a position to have had any of our spacecraft visit Pluto. This grand reconnaissance of the solar system that Voyager did could not include Pluto because Pluto happened to be on the opposite side of the Sun from the other planets. So that's just too bad. One of these days we'll send a mission to Pluto and really figure out what this strange planet is. Some people think that it is simply the one of the innermost bodies in a very, very large distribution of millions of comets or proto-comets. I'll discuss in the next lecture how comets are thought to be icy balls, icy dusty balls that come in from large distances and evaporate as they get close to the Sun. The Kuiper Belt is one of the repositories, one of the reservoirs of these comets that's thought to exist. And Pluto may simply be the largest and one of the most innermost of these Kuiper Belt objects. Indeed, quite a few of these things have been found. Several dozen are now known. They're all smaller than Pluto, but they're not drastically smaller. And Pluto is very strange. It's much smaller than the other jovial planets. And it's not at all like the terrestrial planets, so it seems like an icy, dirty structure like these Kuiper Belt objects. Moreover, Triton is very similar to Pluto in structure, and it goes around Neptune the wrong way. It has a retrograde orbit. So it, too, may be originally from this Kuiper Belt, and then it was captured by Neptune. If that's the case, if Triton, Neptune's moon, and Pluto are both simply the high mass end of this distribution of Kuiper Belt objects, then, in a sense, Pluto shouldn't even be considered a true planet. But it's also possible that that Pluto is a true planet, that maybe it was an escaped moon of Neptune. Maybe Triton and Pluto were both initially moons of Neptune, and then one of them escaped by some gravitational interaction. Another hypothesis is that Pluto was torn away from Neptune by a collision, similar to the collision that is thought to have occurred on Earth and which produced Earth's moon. Now, you might wonder how the mass and radius of Pluto were originally determined. The radius was found with the Hubble Space Telescope pictures quite accurately because the disk is resolved and we know the distance of Pluto, so we can measure its size. But originally, the radius and mass were found by looking at Pluto's moon, Charon. It orbits Pluto, and by measuring the period of the orbit and the distance between the two bodies, one could use Kepler's law to determine the mass of Pluto. In the same way that we use the orbital period and distance of the Earth around the Sun to get the mass of the Sun. The radii were determined by looking at the rotation of, or the revolution of Charon around Pluto. Pluto's axis of rotation is tilted nearly in the orbital plane. Okay, it's kind of like Uranus in that sense. It's actually tilted by 120 degrees, but that's close enough to being in the plane. But what happens is this. Sometimes here from Earth, we see Charon going around Pluto in the plane of the sky, but a quarter of the way around the orbit, we see them mutually eclipsing each other. All right, they pass in front of one another. And then another quarter of the way around, they appear in the plane of the sky again. Well, Pluto's moon, Charon, was discovered just before one of these sequences where the mutual eclipses occurred. And by measuring, by timing the eclipses, how long it takes for Pluto to eclipse Charon and for Charon to eclipse part of Pluto, the relative radii could be determined. So that was very fortunate that the orbital plane, or that the rotation axis is tilted nearly in the orbital plane. All right, well, we don't really know what Pluto is, and maybe we'll find out when a satellite goes there to visit it, but it's certainly a strange planet, crazy orbit, a moon which is half the size of the planet itself. It's even more of a double planet than the Earth-Moon system is. Strange composition. Almost everything about Pluto is strange. Maybe it doesn't deserve to be called a planet, but historically it was called a planet, and most astronomers still call it a planet. But they recognize that it might simply be an escaped object from this Kuiper Belt. Let's now consider the asteroids, the debris of the solar system. These are the minor planets. They occupy a belt around 2.8 astronomical units from the Sun, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. That's right where a planet was predicted to occur. If you look at the spacings of planets, though they're not equal, they follow a fairly regular geometric progression. And a number of people said, gee whiz, you know, there really should be a planet between Mars and Jupiter. There's kind of this big gap between the two, and there really should be one. So people looked for one, and in 1801, a planet was found. It was called Ceres, and everyone was happy. There it is. The geometric progression of the planets is complete. And then a short time later, another one was found, and then another one, and then another one. So this was kind of chaotic. What are those guys doing there? Who asked for them? We now know of something like thousands of asteroids, as they're called, and there may well be about 100,000 of these little bodies floating around out there. Most are pretty small, less than 300 kilometers in diameter in most cases. I think only six or so are bigger than that. And probably most of them are less than 10 kilometers in diameter. But there's a lot of them out there, and their total mass is not huge. It would be less than the mass of any of the terrestrial planets. But you might say, gee, if there are a lot out there that are still there, it could well be that initially there were quite a few more, and they've escaped because of collisions. You know, these rocks collide with one another occasionally and send the things out of the solar system and into the sun and things like that. So it's conceivable that there could have been a smallish terrestrial planet there at some point. Why didn't it form? Or was it broken apart? And if so, why? Well, the answer is that Jupiter is a big bully, all right? Jupiter's got this immense gravitational field, and moreover, it induces large tidal effects. That is, if a planet were trying to form at that location, then Jupiter's gravitational force on the near side of the planet would have been substantially larger than its gravitational force on the far side of the planet, and that would have prevented these planetesimals from gravitationally coalescing into a single planet, okay, a single body. So Jupiter basically tugged on this region of space or on particles in this region of space and did not allow them to come together. Some people think that the thing actually was a planet at one time and then broke apart, but the chemical compositions of the different asteroids actually argue against that. They do have different compositions. Some are rocky, consisting of silicates. Some are mostly iron and nickel. And some are carbon-rich. And in fact, the carbon-rich ones, in some cases, have amino acids and other organic compounds. We've never found an amoeba in one of these things, but there are some simple amino acids in the basic constituents of life in some of these objects. Well, here's a picture, a close-up picture of an asteroid. This is Gaspra, and it was imaged by one of the satellites going out to the outer planets. I believe Galileo's satellite actually took a picture of this asteroid, and you can see it's quite oblong. That's not unexpected for an object of such small size because it never really completely gets molten and doesn't form a nice spherical drop as what water would do if you were to toss a bucket out into a vacuum in outer space. It would form a spherical drop. These objects were never quite that way, and so we expect these kind of irregularly shaped chunks. And they have little craters on them indicating that they've been pockmarked by little collisions. Some actually have big craters. Here's Ida, another oblong one. The interesting thing about Ida is that it has a tiny little moon. Look at that, Dactyl. So Dactyl is orbiting Ida. Not very well, you know. It wouldn't take much of a force to pull Dactyl away, but there it is. It could be a captured moon. Who knows? I don't think it could have lasted 4.5 billion years with its present orbit. Interactions probably would have kicked it away, but who knows, it might have gotten lucky. And a few other asteroids are known with moons. Now, some of these things go through Earth's atmosphere, right? Chunks of rock break away from the asteroid belt when they hit each other, and these are then called meteoroids. They float through the solar system in orbits that do not resemble those of the asteroids. They're now just in some sort of strange orbit. They got broken away from the asteroid belt. And in some cases, meteoroids are probably simply chunks left over from the formation of the solar system. In any case, these meteoroids can in some cases intersect the atmosphere of the Earth and produce the phenomenon that we call a shooting star, a meteor. Now, shooting stars are not stars that have become unglued from the celestial sphere and are zipping down. They are simply little grains, in most cases no bigger than a pebble or a grain of sand, which is entering Earth's atmosphere and burning up due to friction. Okay, they go zipping in and they burn up, they heat up. This is why astronauts are so concerned that the engineers calculate what their re-entry angle should be. And, you know, they're concerned that they have the right sorts of heat shields on their spacecraft so that when they re-enter after a trip to the moon or the space shuttle or whatever, they don't turn into a human, a human meteor. All right. This sort of picture is actually easy to take. You put a camera on a tripod and open, point it to some part of the sky, open the shutter for a fairly long period of time, however long you want, but not so long that the film becomes fogged over. And if you're lucky, one of these things will streak through. Meanwhile, the stars make these streaks that are progressively longer the greater your distance from the celestial pole, simply because the Earth is rotating during your time exposure and the stars leave their trails behind. Those are sort of a reflection of the Earth's rotation. Admittedly, you generally have to wait quite a while before you get a meteor because they don't occur very often in the sky. In a clear, dark sky, you might see half a dozen in an hour, and your camera won't necessarily be pointed in the right direction. In fact, in most cases, it's not pointed in the right direction. So I've taken hundreds of photographs of the sky and have gotten two or three meteors. I think this is my best one. You greatly increase your chances during a meteor shower. Okay. Well, sometimes meteors pass through houses, all right, and things. There, look at that big hole left in the ceiling of a house. This guy's all freaked out, looking at this hole. This was one that made it through the atmosphere and landed, all right? If they're big enough, and if they have the right sort of composition, the ones that are made out of iron tend to survive better than the ones that are made out of carbon, charcoal, they can land on Earth. And there have been one or two recorded cases of someone being hit. One woman in Alabama was actually hit on the side by a meteorite, as they're called when they land, that bounced around a little bit and hit her on the side. And that now, that meteorite, I think, is in a museum somewhere, and she, I think, made a lot of money by selling it to the museum. And fortunately, it didn't, wasn't 6 inches or so over, because that could have hurt quite a lot. And here's one that landed on a house. A few years ago, a woman was inside her house, and she heard a giant crash outside. She went outside, and her brand new car was smashed. The hood was smashed by a meteorite. Again, you can make a lot of money out of these things. If they land on you, you might make a lot of money, but you might not be around to enjoy it. So far, there has not been any case in recorded history of someone actually dying from an impact, all right? But they do land once in a while. A good place to look for them is the Antarctic, okay? If I wander around in the mountains here on the continental United States and find a rock, it's unlikely to be a meteorite, right? If I go around looking at rocks and I claim each one is a meteorite, you'll think I'm a little bit nutty. But a meteorite, a rock found on the surface of the Antarctic ice field, has a pretty good chance of being a meteorite because there are not many natural rocks out there, especially away from some of the mountainous regions. They land on the Antarctic, they get buried in the ice, and then as the ice moves around and evaporates with the seasons and comes and goes, these things surface, and there are expeditions nearly each year to search for Antarctic meteorites. This gives us a cheap way of studying outer space. I mean, here's a meteorite, all right? And this is a way for us to determine the composition directly of stuff out there without having to send a spacecraft to visit it. This is one that is left over from a big impact in the Arizona desert. I'll show a picture of it in the next lecture. But sometimes you can find really great ones. Here's one that was quite large, and the outer crusty region was sort of burned a little bit by the entry through the atmosphere. The crust gets changed a little bit. But as you chip your way down in the interior, you can actually study the rock, and it has been completely unaffected by passage through the Earth's atmosphere. Since these meteorites are so primitive, radioactive dating has shown that they're 4.6 billion years old. This gives us a chance to study the oldest stuff, the oldest material in our solar system. You never find rocks that old on Earth because there's been way too much erosion, subduction underneath the continental plates, volcanism, and so on. The oldest other rocks we know of are the moon rocks, and they date to about 4.4 billion years ago. But the age of the solar system is defined by, really, the age of the, of the meteorites, and they're 4.6 billion years old. Occasionally, you get a really strange one, like this one, which is a meteorite from the moon, in fact. This one has a composition which is quite unlike the ones that are seen elsewhere. They don't look like your normal meteorites. And in fact, they do have the composition of some of the moon rocks that were brought back by the Apollo astronauts. And here's one from Mars. All right, look at this one. This is a rock from Mars. We can tell because it's only 1.3 billion years old. It's not like the 4.6 billion year asteroids or meteorites that are normally found. And its chemical composition resembles that of Mars, not the moon or not the asteroids. The Viking landers in the mid-70s measured the chemical composition of the atmosphere and things like that. So this is one from Mars. And then, of course, as we've already discussed, here's one from Mars that's 4.5 billion years old. It's from an older region on Mars. And this is the rock that contained that evidence of primitive bacteria-like organisms on Mars. So this is a very famous Mars rock. It's the only really old one from Mars that is known. All the other ones are about 1.3 billion years old and are thought to come from this Tharsis volcanic region on Mars that's reasonably young. But this one was an old region and contained that little bacterium, maybe. We even think we know where that one came from. It might have come from either this crater or one other crater. Those are the two most likely craters. So these asteroids or these meteorites provide a cheap way of studying objects way out there in the solar system. And though we still want to visit those objects, we have a way of learning about them very directly prior to sending spacecraft out there.